This week we witnessed one of the most instantaneous transformations of the year. Not rags to riches exactly, more like totally unknown to complete overnight internet sensation. I'm talking about the red sweater guy, Kenneth Bone. Anybody recognize him from last Sunday night's presidential debate? In case you've been out of the loop for the week, there was a presidential debate last Sunday night, and it was a town hall format, which means that certain undecided voters were selected to ask questions that the candidates would answer. And Kenneth Bone was one of eight people who asked a question, 34 years old, from a little town outside St. Louis. He's a worker at a power plant, and he asked a very intelligent, very well-balanced question about the candidates' energy policies. But the interesting thing was not so much the question or the answers, but the fact that the internet lit up immediately with interest in this guy, Kenneth Bone. Just to give you a sense of the response, he got back to his car and retrieved his cell phone, which they hadn't been allowed to carry in, and found a couple of thousand text, Facebook, and Twitter messages waiting for him. Someone immediately created a Facebook fan page for this guy. Several hundred people instantly followed him on Twitter, and he said that previously he only had 7 followers. 2 of those were his grandmother. Somebody tweeted, "I was so sad and ashamed throughout the entire spectacle, but then Kenneth Bone rose like a phoenix from America's ashes, and there's laughter again." Somebody else wrote this, "Tonight I lost hope in America's future. Then I met Ken Bone." Someone proposed we should write him in as a third-party candidate, that he might actually be able to win. Somebody else created a Ken Bone Halloween costume special. You can go on Amazon and buy that, I think, if you would like. A Brooklyn pizzeria created a special name for him, the Ken Bone special. People were wondering throughout the week, a lot of articles and such, what made this guy so fascinating? Why did he suddenly capture America's attention? Somebody guessed on Twitter that it was 33% confidence, 33% calming demeanor, 33% huggability, and 1% power mustache. His 12-year-old son summarized it well. He said, "Dad is now internet famous," which is the best kind of famous there is. It was an overnight transformation. Of course, his 15 minutes of fame are just about done, and we'll probably forget about him very soon. But today, we're talking about transformation. Not the kind that the internet enables to happen overnight. The kind we're talking about can happen quickly, but more often it plays out over years, and it happens through multiple encounters with God. We're talking about the kind of transformation that takes someone who is weak and wandering from one thing to the next, and it turns her into someone who is strong and grounded. Transformation that takes someone fearful and makes him courageous. I'm talking about the kind of transformation that took a man named Jacob and turned him from a fleeing fugitive into the father of a chosen nation. The prophet Isaiah says that God takes people who have been broken by life and he turns them into oaks of righteousness, strong and rooted and grounded. How can our lives be transformed into that kind of life? From what they have been to what they can be? From aimless to purposeful? From cowardly to confident? From broken to beautiful? How do we get there? Today we're going to look at Jacob's story in the Bible for answers. In fact, we're going to look at 2 stories for Jacob in Jacob's life that are kind of like bookends to see the ingredients that make up the kind of transformation that we're longing for. We've been walking through the Bible in kind of an extended sermon series lately. We're calling it the big story because we're trying to see in all the little stories of the Bible how there's one big story that holds them together and that makes it all make more sense and that makes our lives make more sense too. And today I want you to see in Jacob's story 4 crucial ingredients in the kind of transformation that we need. Now, please understand when I say that, you're welcome to take notes. I love it when you take notes, but I'm not hoping that you can do well on a quiz tomorrow about what the 4 points of transformation, 4 ingredients were. No, my hope is more that maybe in one of these, God's Spirit will be nudging you and saying, this is something that you need to think about embracing in your life. So we're going to be looking and reading through the Scripture as we go today. You'll want to have a Bible open. We'll be starting in Genesis chapter 28. If you're using the Pew Bible, you can find that on page 43. We'll start in verse 10 in just a moment. Genesis 28. But first, let me catch you up to where we are in the story. The last 2 weeks, we looked at Abraham and specifically the promises that God made to Abraham. God had promised this aging man and his barren, elderly wife that they would have a miracle child. And that through that child, God was going to give Abraham's family numerous descendants, that they would become a great nation, that he would become the father of many nations, and that through one of those descendants, God would restore and bless people from every nation in the world. God had also promised Abraham that he would give his descendants a land that would be their very own special homeland. Well, we saw last week that the answer to that promise was Isaac, Abraham and Sarah's son. We saw one story from his life. Isaac grows up and he marries Rebekah. God makes Isaac very prosperous. He does well. But just like Sarah was unable to have children, Rebekah is unable to have children. And so she calls out to God in prayer, and God enables her to conceive. Well, while she's pregnant, she gets the feeling that she's not sensing just the normal movements in the womb that any mother would feel. She has the feeling of two babies wrestling within her womb. And so she calls out to God again, asking what this is about. And God tells her, you're pregnant with twins. And the two babies in your womb are going to be the fathers of two nations. And they're wrestling within your womb because they're going to wrestle throughout life. And in fact, they're going to be different than the cultural norm because the older baby is going to serve the younger. You may recall that in that culture, the firstborn son basically got the entire inheritance, almost, carried on the family's reputation, was certainly the most prominent member of the family, and God said, in this case, it's going to be the opposite. The older is going to serve the younger. And when Rebekah gave birth to the twins, the second baby who came out was grasping the heel of the first baby on the way out of the womb, and so they named him Jacob, which in Hebrew means he grasps the heel. Now, that was also an idiom that meant he deceives. And as it turns out, we know from the story, that name would be very true to Jacob the man, who he became. Well, the older son that was born of those two twins was named Esau. And for twins, these guys are just about as different as they possibly could be. Esau, just to use this expression, was kind of like the all-American jock. I mean, he was big and muscular and hairy and masculine, and he loved to hunt. And his father Isaac loved him for it. He cherished his son Esau. He ate the game that Esau hunted in the field, and they gave high fives, and they manned around a lot. But Jacob was a lot different. Jacob loved to stay home with his mom, talk about philosophy and life, keep his hands clean, hang around in the kitchen, learn recipes. I'm not belittling him. That's just how different they were. And the thing is that Jacob was at a disadvantage, you see, because Esau had everything going for him. He was the firstborn. He did all the things that made his dad love him. He had his dad's approval. Jacob couldn't win his dad's approval. His whole life he spent trying to get that. Jacob, in terms of a financial future, had none because he's not the firstborn son. However, Jacob was smart and he was conniving. And he figured out a way to get just about anything that he wanted. For example, there was one time when Esau was out hunting for a long, long time and didn't have the chance to get a meal. And he comes home from a long hunt famished. And he finds Jacob in the kitchen. He's got a nice stew there over the fire. And Esau says, I'm famished. Give me some stew. And Jacob realizes this is my chance. And so he convinces Esau to sell him his birthright. In other words, his status as the firstborn son, all for a bowl of stew. Esau falls for it. And then he hates Jacob for that. And there's a time much later in their lives when their father Isaac is declining in health rapidly. And he's already blind. He can't see. And Isaac realizes that because his days are numbered, it's time to give his deathbed blessing to his firstborn son, Esau. Much more than just a formality. It was a very significant ritual in that day. And so he tells his family, it's time for this deathbed blessing. Well, Jacob realizes that this is another moment of opportunity. And so Esau is out in the field, Jacob dresses up. His mom helps him put animal hair on his arms so he feels more hairy. And he manages to convince his blind father that he's actually Esau, so that his dad will give him the deathbed blessing. Esau comes home and he realizes that Jacob has stolen this blessing from his father, and he is absolutely furious. This is the last straw. And the writer tells us in Genesis 27, Esau held a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing his father had given him. And he said to himself, "The days of mourning for my father are near. Then I will kill my brother Jacob." It becomes his life mission. Jacob takes off just in the nick of time. Just early enough to save his skin, and he's going to find a wife. He's going to go way back to the place that his grandfather Abraham and his father Isaac had come from to find a wife and to be far away from Esau. He knows that his brother could be hot on his heels at any moment, and that's where we're dropping into the story today. Genesis 28, starting in verse 10. Jacob left Beersheba and set out for Haran. When he reached a certain place, he stopped for the night because the sun had set. Taking one of the stones there, he put it under his head and lay down to sleep. Now, with Hebrew stories, we're not often given very many details. And so when we do get some specific details, we can be confident that they're there for a reason. And we get just enough details in this little scene to understand something about the state of mind, kind of the place in life that Jacob was. One thing that we see here is what the author tells us, that Jacob stopped at a certain place. Well, why doesn't he just tell us the name? Because it's a nowhere place. It's not a significant place. It's out in the middle of nowhere where nothing has happened. And so nobody has named it yet. And what that tells us is that here we have Jacob, the son of the family of promise. His father was Abraham, loved by practically everybody, blessed by God, and he has nowhere to lay his head. He can't even get a roof. He's out in the middle of nowhere, laying on the ground. Not only that, but the author tells us that the sun had set. Now, that's partly there to tell us what time of day it was, but it's much more. See, it's often the case in stories in the Bible that when we get a detail about darkness, it's telling us more than just physical darkness, that there is some other kind of darkness here. And what this is telling us is that Jacob's life is in utter darkness. He has been totally cut off. He's cut off from God. He's cut off from everyone that he loves. He's burned every bridge that he has. He's running away from the promised land, not knowing if he is ever going to get back. He's in total darkness. And then we have this interesting detail about the stone, that he lays his head on a stone. I've always wondered, why on earth would you lay your head on a stone? I mean, you're asking for a migraine for a week if you do that. And one possibility is that he didn't want to get a crick in his neck. He needed to prop his head up, and he just didn't have anything. I mean, he was so poor, and he had left home so quickly at that point that he didn't have a cloak, he didn't have a knapsack, anything to ball up and put his head on. He had to use a rock. That's a possibility. But I did some digging this week. There's another possibility, and linguistically in the Hebrew, it's possible that he actually placed stones around his head rather than under his head. And to me, that makes more sense because it gives me the sense that Jacob is so defenseless, he doesn't know if he's going to wake up to Esau standing over him ready to bash his head in. And the only way he can have any means of protection is to put some rocks around his head, and he's kind of just nestled down there in the middle of them. To me, that makes more sense than laying on a rock. Either way, you can tell he is at his wit's end. He's got nothing. He's scared. He's alone. He's defenseless. He's running for his life. He's made his bed, and now he has to lie in it. And what happens next is astounding. Verse 12. He had a dream in which he saw a stairway resting on the earth, with its top reaching to heaven, and the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. So here's Jacob, made a total mess of his life. When he goes to sleep on the ground in the middle of nowhere, God gives him an amazing experience. Jacob has a vision where he sees a stairway. It probably would be like a grand staircase in a Gold Coast mansion. Or maybe the word could even mean a ramp. It's very wide. And what he sees is, at the top, the staircase is touching heaven. And heaven is open. And at the bottom, the staircase is touching the earth. And he sees angels going up and down on this staircase. Now, we have to deconstruct some angels for a moment, because when we think of angels, what do we think about? Clarence, right? It's a Wonderful Life. He looks kind of like Kenneth Bone. Portly, warm, fuzzy, huggable. But with real angels in the Bible, what's the first thing they always say when they show up? Don't be afraid. Why do you think they have to say that? Because they're terrifying. They're not warm and huggable, okay? These are warrior, heavenly warriors. Divine emissaries. They're on royal missions from God. And the sense is that God is giving these warriors of heaven for Jacob's protection. Jacob? That doesn't make sense. But either way, that's what Jacob sees. And God is opening heaven to this scoundrel. He's giving Jacob a glimpse of things that no human being has ever seen before. And then it gets even better, because God comes and God himself speaks to Jacob. Verse 13. There above it stood the Lord, and he said, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. I will give you and your descendants the land on which you are lying. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south. All peoples on earth will be blessed through you and your offspring, your seed. I am with you and will watch over you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. When Jacob awoke from his sleep, he thought, surely the Lord is in this place, and I was not aware of it. He was afraid and said, how awesome is this place. This nowhere place is none other than the house of God. This is the gate of heaven. And we're told later that Jacob named that place, he named it Bethel, or Bethel, which means house of God, because of this encounter. So God says to Jacob, I'm the one who came to your grandfather Abraham. I'm the one who came to your father Isaac and made my promises to them. And now, Jacob, I am confirming that those very same promises are for you. I will give you this land that you're running away from as a permanent homeland for you and your offspring. And they're going to be numerous. Through one of them, I'm going to bless and restore people of every nation. Not only that, Jacob, I myself, the very God of heaven, I will be with you. And that may sound routine. This is the first time in Scripture God has promised that to anybody. I will be with you. I will protect you. I will bring you back home safely. Jacob, I am going to make good on my promises to you. And this encounter with God begins a 20-year process of transformation for Jacob. This is kind of the beginning. We're going to see the end, or the other book end, in just a moment. And this is where we see the first two crucial ingredients in the transformation that we long for. Here's the first. You must encounter God humbly. You must encounter God humbly. Here's what I'm talking about. You have to realize that God gives his grace to people who are totally undeserving. Was Jacob seeking God at this moment? Absolutely not. Jacob was a complete rascal when God came and opened the very heavens to him. That's the kind of people that God chooses to do his work through. You know who I think of when I think about Jacob? I think of that show, Turn, Washington Spies. Anybody seen that show? It's set right here in Setauket. It's a revolutionary spy show. And there's one character on the show, Captain Simcoe. You know who I'm talking about? This is his picture. He has got to be the least likable human being on the planet. I mean, he's like a chameleon. In one moment, he can be sweet and charming and chivalrous, and then he can turn on a dime and be violent and evil. You know he's just a snake. He's just acting that way to get whatever he wants. I saw an interview he did. The actor's name is Samuel Royken, and he said that in real life, people treat him bad because of the character that he has on the show. He says he'll be standing in Starbucks and somebody will give him the finger or an evil look, or they just hate him because of who his character is. But that's how I think Jacob must have been that way, just the most unlikable person because of the way he lived. I mean, he had made enemies of the people that he should have been closest to. He had cheated and lied and stolen and hurt them. Jacob was not a good guy. And here comes God and says, I'm going to open the very heavens to you and pour out blessing on you, and you're the one, Jacob, through whom I'm going to bless people of every nation. God gives his grace to people who are totally undeserving. He opens heaven to Jacob the schemer in a way that not even Abraham, his pious grandfather, got to see. And you're never going to understand the Bible. You're never going to understand God. You're never going to understand life until you realize this. As long as you think that you've done something to merit God's favor, you're going to miss him, and you're going to miss out on the kind of mature, grounded character that he wants to bring about in you. Now, it doesn't mean that God won't bless people who seek him. No, it doesn't. He does bless people who seek him. But the thing is, the more we seek Him and the more we discover Him, the more we realize how undeserving we've been all along for the grace that He's poured out on us. Now, as I say that, my hunch is that some of you are kind of rule-keeper people. You know, you've been to church a lot. You've kept the checklist. You've tried hard to please God, and that doesn't sit so well. That's hard to swallow. And I hope you'll just let it sit for a while. Just let that marinate. But, you know, some of you are here today and you feel a lot like Jacob because you've made a mess. You've wounded some people who care about you. You're running away from the messes that you've made. And this is good news because Jacob's story shows us that God pursues us right in the midst of the messes that we've made, that He is intent on keeping His promises to restore us, to restore what we've broken. When we see that, when we see this, it tells us to come to God humbly in awe of His grace. There's a second important ingredient here. If you're going to be transformed from fearful to faithful, to cowardly to courageous, then you have to encounter God personally. You see, Jacob has heard the stories. He knows about Abraham's God. He knows about Isaac's God. He knows probably about the prophecy that his mother got when she was pregnant about how the older would serve the younger. But Jacob doesn't know God. At the point where we drop into the story, his life has been totally different from Abraham's or Isaac's. He hasn't trusted in God. He hasn't been this great example of obedient faith. He's been a total schemer. He's burned every bridge that he has. He's without family, without friends, without belongings. He's leaving the promised land, thinking there's no way that God's promises could ever extend to him. And it's only when he encounters God personally that transformation begins. Thankfully, God initiates it. He comes to Jacob and gives him this encounter in the middle of the night, so that God's no longer just Abraham's God. He's no longer just Isaac's God. He's Jacob's God after this point. And that has to happen in your life. You have to encounter Him personally. He can't just be your parents' God or your grandparents' God or your friend's God. He has to be your God. And here's why this matters so much for you today. In a church like this, it would be quite possible for you to enjoy coming to church and ride the wave of momentum from other people's relationships with God without ever actually encountering Him yourself. Some of you have been coming to church a long time and you believe all the right things about God, and yet you've never really surrendered your life totally to Him and let Him take over your entire being. Some of you are here for the first time. You've only been coming a week, 2 weeks, a few months, maybe a couple of years, and you're loving it. You enjoy coming here because of the music and the teaching, and there's a sense of energy. There's a sense of something positive happening here. And yet you're riding that wave of other people's relationship with God without having yet encountered Him for yourself. Now, this is not to negate all the things that we say about community and relationships. Those are vital. But it has to be balanced by this. You need to encounter God personally. And for some of you, today might be the day where you first say, you know what, that's me. I need to call out to Him, give Him my life, encounter Him individually and personally, and I hope that you'll do that. Ethel Weeks is a great example of that. Ethel's here today. I warned her that I was going to mention her. But I love Ethel's story. She came and she sat here in the pews for 15 years without really ever encountering God personally, going through the motions. And she says that it was about 2 years ago when she felt moved to start reading the Bible for herself. And as she did, she discovered that God's grace was far more abundant than she ever realized. It moved her to go to Alpha, to seek God in a more intentional way, to ask some questions, which led her to go to Beta and to grow deeper. And Ethel's just basically been set on fire. I mean, she's an inviter par excellence, inviting people to come to Alpha, to plug into to various things, to encounter God. You can sit here in church for a long time without it ever becoming real. And my hope is that for some of you, it'll become real today. You need to encounter God personally. And when you do, there's a third ingredient that I think you'll discover. We see this one 20 years later when Jacob meets God again. So why don't you go ahead and flip over a few chapters later to chapter 32. You can put your finger there. We'll go there in just a moment. But what happens in between? Well, after this vision of heaven open, the stairway coming down, Jacob's touched, all right, but he's not transformed. You can see it right after he gets up in the morning, what he says. He says, all right, God, great. If you'll do those things for me, the things you promised, you know, if you'll protect me, you bring me back home, then I'll serve you. Then I'll give you a tenth of everything that I have. Kind of makes this conditional promise, like a lot of us, you know, we're, all right, God, if you give me a beautiful spouse, you give me a nice job, great income, financial security, all that, okay, you got a deal, I'll serve you. Or you get me out of this mess I've made, then I'll be yours, I'll worship you. Jacob is doing that. And so he goes. He goes on his journey to his uncle Laban's house, where he moves in, and he marries not one, but two women. Never a good idea. They happen to be sisters. Even worse idea. Creates all kinds of headaches. Rachel and Leah become his wives. Jacob eventually has lots of children, who we'll talk more about next week. And over the next 20 years, he becomes quite wealthy. Now, that wealth didn't come easily, because his uncle Laban was just as much of a scoundrel as he was. And he had to be especially cunning in order to not get outsmarted. But over the 20 years, if you read those chapters, only about four chapters, I encourage you to read them during the week, you can see some slow character growth starting to happen in Jacob. And eventually God speaks to him and he says, Jacob, it's time. Get your family together. Go home to the promised land. There's just one problem. Remember what it is? Esau. Remember, he had said, I am going to kill Jacob. And Jacob knows that. He knew that as soon as Isaac passed away, his head could be on the chopping block. And he thinks about it. Now, let me ask you, is this the same old fearful Jacob? Mm-mm. Oh, he's afraid, sure. He knows the risk. But it doesn't keep him from going. And so he gets his family together, all of his wives and servants and children and livestock. Of course, all of his wealth consists of basically livestock at this point. And he sets out. One road, headed back home. He knows that eventually Esau is probably going to be coming down the road to meet him. And so Jacob sends some messengers ahead to find out what's going on, kind of some spies. He sends them with some presents in case they meet Esau. They can kind of start to kiss up a little bit, put him at ease. And the messengers come back and they say, Jacob, it's not good. Esau's coming and he's bringing hundreds of men with him. It's an army. Jacob realizes this, he could lose everything. This could be it. And so on the night before he is bound to meet Esau, Jacob sends his family off and he gets alone. And that's where we drop back into the story. He's just called out to God. We're not going to read this part, but in the beginning of chapter 32, Jacob has just prayed a beautiful prayer based on God's promises from 20 years before. And then this is what happens in the night, verse 24 of chapter 32. So Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him till daybreak. When the man saw that he could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip, so that his hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. Now this is a very, very mysterious encounter. Scholars have spilled a lot of ink trying to understand it, trying to explain it. What is clear is that this is not a friendly encounter. Jacob gets pummeled in the night, blindsided. Now, there's a play on words here that we tend to miss in English with the name Jacob. Remember, that name means to grasp? Well, in Hebrew, that word is here. It literally says that this guy Jacobed Jacob, grasped him, wrestled him. He's being assaulted. He's fighting for his life, trying to survive. He doesn't know who this is. It's dark. There's no electric lights around, no flashlight. And then something really strange happens. Because after they struggle for a while, this mysterious attacker in the night reaches down and literally just gives Jacob the slightest tap on the hip, just a little touch. And in an instant, Jacob feels intolerable pain. In fact, that little touch did so much damage, he's permanently disabled from this point forward. His hip is totally wrenched. And in that moment, Jacob realizes, if this is someone who can totally incapacitate my hip with one little tap, this is no ordinary man. This is somebody divine. Jacob realizes that he has been wrestling with God himself. Look at what happens next, verse 26. Then the man said, let me go, for it is daybreak. But Jacob replied, I will not let you go unless you bless me. You got to see what happens here. See, for as long as Jacob can remember, he's been at a disadvantage because of his circumstances. Remember? Yeah, he's not the firstborn. He's always under the thumb of his brother. If he could just take care of his brother, then maybe he'll be okay. He's never had his father's approval. He has to really, really work his way into his father's love. He hasn't been assured of that. All what he really needs is a secure place, you know, where he can be protected, and then he'll be okay. You know what he really needs is a beautiful wife like Rachel. And then his uncle Laban is even trying to keep that from him. You see, there's always some circumstance that has to be fixed for Jacob to be okay, and he's been weaseling, he's been deceiving, trying to get those things. But what happens here? He realizes that he's in the grasp of God, and he clings for dear life. See, all along as Jacob has been wrestling to survive, he's been trying to get free. And in this moment, when he realizes that it's God, he could get free. And he's clinging for his life. He says, I won't let go until you bless me. He's saying, now I realize that what I've been asking for you to give me and all these other things is actually found in your embrace, and I am not letting go. Here's the third ingredient that brings the transformation that we're longing for. You must discover that everything you've sought through God is actually found in God. Everything that you thought you needed to be complete and fulfilled that God could give you, it's all found in Him. The beauty that you thought was found in Mr. Right or Miss Right, it's actually found in God. The approval that you thought you needed from your parents or from a boss, it's actually His approval that you're longing for. The security that you thought you were going to find in a good portfolio, it's actually found in Him. You need to hear this. Whether you've been coming to church all your life or whether you're brand new to church. If you're brand new, this would probably make sense to you because you think, oh yeah, I've been looking for love in all the wrong places. I've been trying to find satisfaction in this or that. Yeah, I can see how that makes sense. But if you've been church all your life, you've been a religious person, so to speak, you've probably been seeking God, thinking that He was going to give you everything that you need, all of the stuff. And some of us go on with life for a long time doing that without realizing it's actually Him that we long for, His embrace. And until you realize this, you're not going to be transformed. You're not going to be grounded. You're always going to be wandering from one solution to the next, realizing that that one didn't work. Let me try the next thing. You must discover that everything you've sought through God is actually found in God. Jacob realizes that in this moment. So he clings to God, and he asks for the blessing that is found in Him. And then we read this in verse 27. The man asked him, "What is your name?" Now think with me for a moment, folks. If this is God, does He need to ask Jacob's name? Of course not. He knows who it is. There must be another reason here. "What's your name?" "Jacob," he answered. You know what I think he's doing? He's making Jacob say it out loud. "Deceiver, that's my name. That's who I've been." It's kind of a confession. Jacob says it. And then verse 28, the man said, "Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel," which means God fights, "because you have struggled with God and with humans and have overcome." You know what just happened? God just gave Jacob a new identity. That's what God does. That's His business, giving people new identities, real transformation. And every time His name is spoken, Jacob's new name, Israel, is spoken from now on, it's going to be a reminder of this encounter with God, the night that he struggled with God, because this is where everything changed. And it's not only his new name, as you know, it becomes the name of the nation that will become of his descendants. This is where everything changes for Jacob. This new identity. Look at verse 29. We just looked. Verse 29. Jacob said, "Please tell me your name." But he replied, "Why do you ask my name?" Then he blessed him there. Verse 30. So Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, "It is because I saw God face to face, and yet my life was spared." The sun rose above him. Notice that? The sun rose above him as he passed Peniel, and he was limping because of his hip. Therefore, to this day, the Israelites do not eat the tendon attached to the socket of the hip, because the socket of Jacob's hip was touched near the tendon. Now, the narrator tells us that the sun rose there, partly because he wants us to know what time it is, but partly because it's another bookend. Remember, the sun was setting, Jacob was in total darkness, the sun is rising. It's a new day. This is a new transformed man. He's not perfect yet. If you read the story, you know that's true. But he has been significantly transformed. He's humble now. If you continue to read, what happens the next day, he gets up and he goes and he meets Esau and he bows down humbly before Esau and he apologizes for all the pain he's inflicted. He gives Esau tons of wealth as a way of making amends and saying how sorry he is for the wrong that he's inflicted on him. And they hug. Esau has apparently been changed as well because he forgives Jacob. He embraces him. They're reconciled. It's one of the most beautiful pictures of reconciliation in the whole Bible. And Jacob comes back to live in Canaan, the promised land. Now, here's the last ingredient that you need to see today if you're going to experience the kind of deep transformation that you long for. You must encounter God in weakness. In weakness. And there's two kinds of weakness that you got to see here. First, you got to encounter God in your weakness. That was true of Jacob. In both stories that we saw today, in chapter 28, Jacob was weak because of his own mistakes. He had created those problems, and he was weak and defenseless for those reasons. But what's different in chapter 32? Jacob's doing all the right things at this point, right? He's got a prayer life. He's calling out to God. He's facing his fears. He's going to meet Esau. We would expect if he's doing all the right things, God's going to just pour out the blessing on him. But what happens? God comes and Jacob's him. He pummels him and permanently disables him. What kind of a God does that? He knows Jacob is not going to discover that everything he longs for is in God until Jacob is at a place of weakness where he has to cling to God for dear life. And you know what? I think that's very true for us as well. Some of us are in a place today where we feel assaulted by God. I see the prayer list every week that comes in, and some people in our church family are just getting pounded over and over, one thing after the next. And I see it, and I think, not something else. How long, Lord? And I don't have any easy answers for you. I cry out to God for mercy if you're in that place. But I do know this, that somehow, when we get to our weakest, most vulnerable points and we cry out to God and we cling to Him, that's usually when He does His best work in us. One writer said it well. He said that God has to often wrestle us into a transformed life rather than comfort us into a transformed life, because we don't learn so well when we're comfortable. You must encounter God in your weakness. But I said there were two kinds of weakness where we need to encounter God today. And the last one is vital. You must encounter God in His weakness. His weakness. You see, one of the strangest aspects of this story in Genesis 32 is in verse 25, where this divine wrestler apparently acknowledges that he cannot overpower Jacob. How can that be? I mean, if he's God, can't he overpower him? He was clearly strong enough to just tap his hip and make him permanently crippled. What's going on here? God has chosen to make Himself weak, to limit Himself in this moment. You see, He could, of course, He could just exert His full strength and totally destroy Jacob, but then He wouldn't get what He wants, which is a relationship with a transformed man. He has to limit Himself and make Himself weak so that Jacob can encounter Him the way that he needs to. And you know that is going to be one of the most important threads that holds together the entire story of the Bible. Because God did His greatest work of all time, saving us from death, saving us from our sin, by becoming weak. And do you know where the story of Jacob comes full circle in the big story of the Bible? It's in one little story in John chapter 1. It's a beautiful story. We're going to close with this. It happens about 1,600 years later at least. There are a few guys who have started to follow Jesus. He's not very well known yet. But one of those guys is named Philip. And Philip wants to go get his friend Nathanael. And Philip comes up to Nathanael and he says, "You're not going to believe it. We found the Messiah, God's promised rescuer. He's here, the one we've waited for. His name is Jesus, and he's from a place called Nazareth." And Nathanael says, "Nazareth? That's a nowhere place. God doesn't do great things in nowhere places." Sound familiar? And Philip says, "Okay, well, just come and see for yourself." And Nathanael gets up and he goes with his friend and he's walking up to Jesus. And when he does, Jesus says something that would have clearly caught Nathanael's attention because it harkened back to the Jacob story. He said, "Ah, Look at that. There is a true son of Israel, Jacob's new name, in whom there is no deceit. Now, Nathanael's a good Jewish boy. He knows the stories of Jacob. That would have started to make his wheels turn. And Nathanael says, well, that's interesting. Yeah, my friends tell me I'm a straight shooter, pretty authentic guy. How did you know that? We've never met before. It's kind of like he's a New Yorker. How do you know me? We never met before. Jesus says, I saw you under the fig tree, Nathanael. Nathanael's totally floored. You know what we know about the fig tree? Not a thing. But apparently Nathanael has had some encounter with God sitting under a fig tree that is so deep, so intimate, so personal, that if Jesus knows about it, he must be divine. Because in the very next moment, Nathanael falls down and he worships him. He says, you are the King of Israel. You are the Son of God. And then Jesus says something that'll floor you if you understand it. He said, you think that's something, Nathanael? Listen to this. Very truly, I tell you, you will see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. What's Jesus alluding to? Jacob's staircase. That vision where Jacob saw heaven open to a scoundrel. God affirming his promises to a rascal. Jesus says, you know that stairway, that staircase that connected heaven and earth, that opened heaven for human beings? The way that God could pour out his grace on somebody totally undeserving? Guess what? I'm the stairway. It's always been pointing to me. I'm the one that opens heaven for human beings. I'm the one that gives you access to God. And you're going to see things if you come with me that no human being has ever seen before. You know why? Because I didn't come just to show you the steps. I didn't come just to tell you how to get to heaven and how to get to God. I came to be the steps. I came to do them for you. I came to live the perfectly loving, perfectly faithful, perfectly righteous life that you couldn't live. And the only way that we could see heaven open, that we could know God in the way that he revealed to Jacob and even more, is because God was willing to become totally weak in the person of Jesus on a Roman cross, a Roman instrument of execution, to completely disavow himself of his power and be crucified under the full weight of divine judgment against my sin and your sin so that we wouldn't have to bear it. And only when you see God becoming weak for you in Christ will you truly know the kind of transformation that we long for. Only then does a coward become courageous because you see that you're totally secure in what Jesus did for you. Only then does a rascal become someone who is revered. Transformation may happen quickly. More likely, it will take many years. But if you encounter God in the weakness of Christ, you will be transformed. I want to spend a few moments with our heads bowed, and just a moment of reflection and prayer. The worship team is going to come and begin to play. And I want you to take a moment to think about the things that we've talked about today. I wonder, is there maybe one of these areas that you're sensing is an area where you need to respond? It may be that you're realizing today for the first time you need to encounter God humbly, that you've been approaching him hoping that he would somehow bless you and honor you because of what you've earned and what you've tried hard to do, and you just need to come before him broken and receive his grace. It may be that you need to encounter him personally. You're realizing that for the first time today, and if that's the case, you can say a simple prayer. Jesus, I want you to come into my life. Take control of me. It may be that you realize you've been seeking all the blessings through God and that you need to find them in him. You need simply him. Allow him to embrace you. It may be that you're already at a place of total weakness today and you need God to come and meet you there. Whatever it is, take just a moment silently where you are in prayer with God. Acknowledge how you want to respond to him. Father, it totally blows our minds that you would bring your abundant grace to people who are totally undeserving like we are, that you would pursue us in the midst of our messes. Thank you that you're faithful. Thank you that your Spirit hears our prayers in this moment. We pray now that in these moments that follow as we worship you, you would be responding to us, pouring out your healing and your grace and your transforming power in our lives. Through Jesus, our Lord, we pray. Amen.